From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Have you ever wondered where your used stuff goes after you get rid of it? Old clothes, furniture, electronics, or other once-useful items? Your donation to the local Goodwill or thrift store could very well be the beginning of a dynamic second life for those newly minted secondhand goods. The supply of discarded reusable items is growing around the world, as is their demand for an increasing number of people who find great value in used goods. So yes, the saying goes that one man's trash is another man's treasure. But even with a burgeoning secondhand goods economy, there is still too much treasure and too much trash. So what do we do about that? This hour on Point, explorations in the new global garage sale and the afterlife of stuff. And you can join us. Do you know where your donated stuff really goes? Or have you just stopped buying new things altogether and only purchase secondhand goods? And even if we do have a second life for discarded materials, does that do anything to solve the underlying problem, which is that we buy too much stuff to begin with? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from New York is Adam Minter. He is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and author of the new book, Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam Minter, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, what I'd love to do is kind of touch down on a couple of different places around our humble little planet Earth. And hear about, you know, how you, the people and the businesses that you've explored that are actually, you know, doing things with secondhand stuff. So let's start with in the United States, these businesses that have popped up to help folks downsize, especially empty nesters. Why is that one of the key stories you begin with?
Sure. Well, because it's something that I think all of us as Americans face. You know, at some point, either us or our parents or our grandparents or somebody we're close to is going to downsize their home, perhaps to go into a retirement community, or, you know, more grimly, they're going to pass away and we're going to be left with homes filled with stuff. This is something that I've been through that need to be cleaned out. So over the last 20 years, an entire industry has emerged to actually handle these precise kinds of situations, and these clean out companies, if you will go into homes and will take the stuff out. And in many cases, they will then try to find the best place for that stuff to go. And by best place, that usually means the place that will pay them for it, so it can help to defray the expense of cleaning out and also disposing of the stuff that simply doesn't have a home.
Well, I mean, and one of the things that you talk about is even how people want to get rid of these things, they still attach so much emotional weight to them. That this is one of the reasons why they need advice. They need to actually pay someone
exactly
to help them to get rid of things.
Exactly. And you know, some of these cleanout companies are very highly paid, and they serve as much as counselors and sort of therapists for people going through this cleanout process, you know, reassuring folks that, say, the wedding china is going to end up somewhere good because people want that china. And by the way, you have four or five sets of dishes already. You can't bring that to the retirement community.
Yeah.
So we get—
People,
you know,
want
we,
that
we,
china, but their kids, their own kids may not want it.
And this is the classic problem, is that, you know, so many people, and I've been on cleanouts where people will say to the cleanout professionals, oh, no, we can't send that to Goodwill. My kids will want it. And the truth is, your kids don't want it. They don't want that heavy brown furniture, as it's sometimes called, you know, the heavy oak furniture. They more often than not don't want the wedding china. And so as a result, that stuff needs to find a new home. It needs to be rehomed. And that's one of the tensions here, is there's just too much stuff.
You know, I think this hits home for so many people, right? Because I'm just thinking in my own life, my mom every once in a while will send me an email saying, I'm cleaning out the garage, because she's doing, you know, my brother and I a big favor and trying to get rid of stuff before mm-hmm. it's too late. And she asks me, what do you want me to keep? And I continuously tell her, unless it's family photos or important documents or maybe one or two things that we all treasure, I don't want you to keep any of it, because we don't actually have that many family heirlooms anymore.
Right, right. You know, and I think, you know, it's a very common experience now for Americans to have this sense of dread over a relative's passing away, not just because you lose that person from your life, but you actually gain their stuff. And then it's up to you to figure out what to do with this house full of stuff. And as you just indicated, so much of it really doesn't have any value except to the people who purchased it initially. It may have been a $2,000 dining room set when it was purchased, but you're going to have a very hard time getting an estate sale to sell it for $2,000. And if you bring it to Goodwill, for example, or the Salvation Army, you may find that they are only able, if they can sell it at all, only to be able to do it for a very small percentage of what it's worth. And so then the question comes, well, who's going to pay to even move that heavy piece of oak furniture to the Goodwill or the Salvation Army?
Right. And, you know, so this idea that there's very little or less and less that families deem worth saving intergenerationally, right? Like there aren't as many heirlooms, perhaps, as we once had. It really sort of brings together a lot of the issues that you talk about in the book. One is durability. Like, stuff just doesn't last as long, so it's not as high quality. Two, perhaps because we live in such a consumer culture, we just buy, and buy, and we're not assigning sort of heirloom meaning to things anymore. It just seems like there's been a really big cultural shift in the past 50 years or so.
Yeah. Or you could even say there's been a big cultural shift over the last 200 years since the onset of the Industrial Revolution. Because if we just take clothing, for example, clothing, you know, the idea 200 years ago that you would have a piece of clothing that you wear 1 to 5 times, which is what happens with most fast fashion, is absurd. I mean, somebody in your household would make that clothing. There would be a lot of labor that goes into it. There would be the necessity to purchase the fabric. It was a measure of wealth. There's a reason why people gave, you know, things like linens and towels and other things as wedding gifts, because it was wealth and it's something that could be passed along. But now, you know, a piece of clothing, a set of linens, you can go to Target or Walmart or wherever it is, and it's really, you know, you barely notice it coming out of your disposable income. So what we have is we have increasingly cheap things, but it's increasingly cheap, you know, so it only lasts a few washes and then you need to buy something else. And, you know, your children aren't going to be interested, you know, in that $9.99 bed sheet. You know, they can go and buy their own $9.99 bed sheet or perhaps buy something more expensive.
So I want to return in a moment to our sort of global hopscotch of places that you visited to talk about the secondhand goods economy. But since you mentioned fast fashion, we have to spend a little time on this, Adam, because
sure.
I think the numbers are just appalling. You have some very interesting numbers about sort of the textile or fashion industries. I'm conflating two things here, but their contribution to climate change, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I mean, you know, the numbers that are out there related to fashion, textiles, and climate change are really quite alarming. You know, by some accountings, it can be responsible for, in total, around 10% of global carbon emissions. And that number is probably growing simply because the demand for clothing, and especially the demand for low-cost clothing that doesn't last very long, is growing, especially in emerging markets where we have new consumers who want stuff and can't afford a price point that allows you to make a more durable product. So it is very alarming.
Okay. Just that fact alone, we should do endless numbers of hours about fast fashion. And I want to leave our minds open here for someone to call in and with their defense of fast fashion. But Adam, let's get back to some of the places you visited around the world. There's a mile-long swap meet near the U.S.-Mexico border.
Sure. If you go down to Nogales, Mexico, which is just across the border, literally across the border from Nogales, Arizona, on the weekends, you can see it. And it is just that. It's a swap meet that goes for a mile down a road called Colosio. And it is pretty much 99% newly brought over used American stuff, primarily purchased from Goodwills and Salvation Armies and other discount stores in Arizona. And scattered throughout, you'll find some food and a little bit of new stuff, but primarily it's used stuff that has been imported over the border from Arizona. And it's you know, if you're like me, if you like used stuff and thrift shops, it's a lot of fun to see. If you're interested in globalization, it's also really fun to see because you do get a sense of just how globalized demand has become for price points that newly emerging consumers can afford.
So tell us more about that. You said that traders are basically scouring thrift shops on the U.S. side and then selling them on the Mexico side. What does that tell us about the demand, who's buying, things like that?
Sure. Sure. Well, in reporting this book, I actually spent some time with a guy who asked that I not use his real name. So we use we give him the name Shoe Guy.
The Shoe Guy.
And his specialty is used shoes. And he is from Nogales, the Mexican side. But he's been in this business of secondhand for most of his life. He's in his 40s now. And what he does now is several times a week, sometimes 5 days a week, he will drive up from Nogales and he will literally drive to every one of the Goodwills in Tucson. And that's usually, there's 16 total. There's a couple he won't go to, but he can usually do a circuit of about 12 in a few hours. And he has a circuit through the stores he will walk through looking for things that he knows are in demand in Mexico and very quickly buy them, go back to Nogales, drop the stuff off where he stores it, and then oftentimes go back a second time during the day and make another round because the Goodwills are constantly getting new stuff from people in the Tucson area who are downsizing their homes. And there's a lot of downsizing and moving in Tucson because of the military and the elderly populations there. He's very interesting because he started out selling it into Nogales just sort of person to person. But he's become big enough now that he's dealing with traders who put in orders with him for, you know, different kinds of shoes. And then they don't just sell them in Nogales. But as Mexico becomes more affluent, the people who are buying from him are actually bringing his goods further down, further south into Mexico, into parts of Mexico that are developing. And this is a huge trade. It's not just Shoe Guy. I mean, if you look at the interstate, you'll see pickup trucks filled with stuff rolling towards Mexico every day from Tucson.
Well, we are talking this hour with Adam Minter. His new book is Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And we're talking about the life and economy of secondhand goods, discarded stuff. And also, there's always that big question, are we still just consuming too much to begin with? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Adam Minter. He's author of the new book, Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale, where Adam traveled around the world to discover and explore the global economy for secondhand goods. And also he does ask the fundamental question, even if things have a second, third, fourth, or fifth life, are we still just consuming too much? So we want to hear from you. First of all, do you think that or have you moved to buying or using only secondhand goods? Do you know where your stuff goes, where you when you discard it or donate it? Adam, look, this we knew in advance that this would be a conversation that got a lot of listener feedback. So let me just read you a bunch of stuff that's already come in on our website.
Sure.
Sanders Dogman says, throw it away and buy a new one, grows the economy. Creaker says, I hope some mention is made of the gifting economy. In my community, there are Facebook buy nothing groups that gift everything from used and unused items to leftovers from a party. And Toyota says, will we ever cut down on the amount of stuff we need as successive generations spend more time than the last interfacing with a digital screen? Will there be less need for physical stuff and more need for digital stuff? Will we ever reach peak physical stuff? Now, on that note, Adam, can you just describe to us how much has our consumption of material goods increased in the past generation?
Yeah, from the 1960s until last year, the amount of money that we spent on durable goods. So durable goods are everything from sofas to cell phones, if you will. Doesn't include food and textiles. Increased 20-fold. So we are spending more and more and more every year on stuff. And you know, you can see it. If you drive down a suburban street and people open up their garages, it's filled with stuff, not cars. In fact, there's data actually tracking that, how many people in Los Angeles can't fit their cars in their garages anymore because there's so much stuff that is overflowing out of their homes.
Okay. Well, let's just take some callers here because, wow, people want to talk about secondhand stuff. Janine is calling from New Orleans. Janine, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna and Adam. Thank you for this topic. It's something I've been talking about and doing for many years because I'm an aging hippie, and I grew up in a time when people, that was the consciousness. Don't throw your stuff away. Give it away. Use it again. And I have followed that philosophy throughout my whole life. Sure, it saves money. Adam talks about the economic impact, the global environmental impact. But one of the best things about being in the secondhand or used or recycled economy is that it's so damn fun.
Yes.
Out there, I'm hanging blinds that I found alongside the road in my town. And I knew they would be close to fitting my windows, but I took them home, measured them, they fit, I'm cleaning them up, they're going up today.
Great. Well, Janine, I'm so happy to hear that you're in the midst of giving something a second life. But I have a question for you, Janine. Mm-hmm. You know, even so, what's behind what you just said, though, is that in this day and age, even if you're just getting more secondhand stuff, you're still giving something else away. So there's this like consumption cycle that hasn't gone away. Like it might be new to you, even if it's old to someone else, but that's because you just got rid of something else. Shouldn't we just be like consuming less?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I mean, my friends call me a hoarder, but there is a method to my madness because when I find something that can be recycled, I clean it up, repair it, put it in a consignment store, and there's jingle in my pocket.
Janine, thank you so much for your call. Adam, do you want to respond to Janine?
Well, first of all, I totally agree with her. I mean, thrifting and you know, Goodwills and Salvation Armies are fun places, and you know, this was in many cases a very fun book to write and report because it gave me the opportunity to go to these places, and as I actually write in the book, you know, one of the hardest parts of this book was temptation. You know, I constantly wanted to buy stuff that I was seeing, even though it was secondhand stuff, and for the most part, I resisted it. But it gets to a broader point, and that is something that one of the cleanup professionals I encountered early on in this book told me and said, you know, hoarding is a spectrum disorder. We all are hoarders to some degree. It's just to what degree? And that continued to come back to me over and over as I worked on this book. And, you know, it really comes back to this idea that you know, to some extent, we all need to resist that impulse a little bit more.
Mm. Well, let's get back to our globe-trotting here, Adam, because you really opened my eyes to these economies that form around secondhand stuff. I mean, tell us a little bit about, for example, what happened to burgeoning businesses in South Asia that recycled textiles?
Right. Well, this is a very interesting situation. We're thinking right now of a place called Panipat,
yes,
India, which for about 30 to 35 years has been sort of the capital of wool clothing recycling in the world. And wool is a difficult fabric actually to recycle. It can't be used for very much, especially as a wiping rag, which is what happens to a lot of cotton shirts, for example. Your T-shirts more often than not become just rags that can wipe things up, but wool doesn't absorb very well. So in Panipat, what they did was imported basically technology that dates back to early 19th century Britain that takes wool sweaters and other wool garments, rips them up, extracts the individual fibers, and then reweaves them into, more often than not, blankets, which were then sold to relief agencies like the Red Cross. And so for over the last few decades, whenever you see relief agencies like the Red Cross dropping blankets into disaster zones where there had been floods or earthquakes, whatever, more often than not, those blankets were recycled from wool that had been imported into Panipat from around the world, mostly from cold weather climates, obviously, ripped apart and then run through machinery in Panipat and transformed into new blankets. So it was a really great business for a number of years, but it's now in decline because of basically polar fleece. And polar fleece...
which we're supposed to be really like happy with because it's recycled milk bottles, right?
I mean. Right. But the problem is, there are certain advantages to it. And if you ever have dealt with one of these relief blankets, they smell like a recycled blanket. There's a little bit of a mustiness to them. The colors in the blankets aren't really great, and they're just not comfortable. Whereas, a polar fleece blanket feels great. And about 10 years ago, Chinese manufacturers had really mastered the art of making low-cost polar fleece, and they started competing directly with Panipat. And they can not only make more blankets that are sort of more pleasant blankets, but they can do it more quickly than Panipat. So the Red Cross may order at one time 200,000 blankets, and Panipat just can't do that as quickly as a polyester or a polar fleece factory in China. So as a result, that recycling industry, the shoddy industry is what it's called, that wool is called shoddy, is in decline in Panipat, and it raises big questions about what's going to happen to all of this wool clothing now that polar fleece is pushing it out.
I mean, I presume it'll go where so much other clothing goes, right? In the incinerator or the landfill.
Yeah, exactly. Some of it might be able to be used as stuffing in certain applications, but ultimately it's going to become harder. And in the book, I spend some time in Panipat, go there with a trader, who tells me, he says, it's going to reach a point where consumers are going to be faced with that choice. Do we want this stuff thrown away, incinerated, or reused? And if they want it reused, they're going to have to pay for it to be reused because as a business, a self-supporting business, it's becoming harder and harder and harder.
How much is this driving down of the price point for new items affecting the global, various global markets for secondhand goods?
It's a real issue. It's a 200-year-old issue, but it's become a much bigger issue in the last 40 years as South Asian and East Asian manufacturing has really come online and figured out how to make low-cost clothing. In the book, I spend some time at a Goodwill store in Tucson that's across the street from a Walmart. And one of the things that was pointed out to me over and over and over is that the Walmart's price on new trousers, for example, new jeans, oftentimes is price competitive with the used stuff in the Goodwill. And so the Goodwill has to consciously not just price, but also even, decorate its store, light the store, paint the walls so that it is a pleasant place and a place that can compete with the Walmart. But ultimately, what's said to me over and over in that store and in other places around the world is that you give people the choice, even if you're talking about a more durable pair of jeans, a pair of jeans that's good enough to be resold in a Goodwill, people more often than not are going to opt for that new pair of jeans for the same price, even though they know it's not going to last as long.
There's something about shiny and new which hits our lizard brain, I swear. Okay, let's go let's go back to the callers. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Glasgow, Kentucky. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, my comment is just the fact that Adam talked about Walmart products being cheaper, and the price being lower. I think a lot of people are not as concerned about the durability of the product at this point in time because they want to change fashion so often.
And so it's just part of a lifestyle, you're saying, Steve?
Yeah, I think, of course, they see people run down the runway with this new style, and then Walmart offers that in a few months, and then next thing you know, they go, well, I want the new style, so they pass their old clothes off to Goodwill, and they've only worn them 3 times, and so therefore, they're okay with it not lasting as long. I'm old school. I don't operate that way, but I can kind of see how that happens.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. Adam, let's talk about this issue of durability more. I mean, Steve's saying, especially in fast fashion, it is very much, it can be seen as a lifestyle decision because people want those new fashions quickly. But the issue of durability is kind of in most consumer goods now. I mean, it's getting harder to find an affordable thing that lasts.
Yeah, that's very true. And there's sort of a paradox here because you know, it's harder to find that affordable thing that lasts. And yet, increasingly, if you go to consumer surveys, you know, for appliances, for example, consumers are increasingly frustrated that their washing machines, for example, don't last as long as they used to. And, you know, there's some really great data on product durability and lifespan coming out of Europe, which shows that what consumer expectations are, for example, for a washing machine are simply not being met by today's washing machines. They're just made too cheaply. And as a result, you know, you've got this level of frustration that's bubbling underneath the surface there, which in some sense is a real business opportunity for somebody to come around and meet those expectations for durable products. Just to Steve's point on fashion, he's absolutely right. And it's not a new problem. I mean, we were seeing complaints along the same lines from people saying, you know, from the fashion industry saying, you know, consumers, especially younger consumers, want to wear that runway look as far back as the 1970s. Sure. And they're willing to sacrifice quality to get at it. So it's not a new problem. And it's kind of an existential issue for the fashion industry, because the fashion industry is increasingly concerned about sustainability. And yet this idea that you should have, you know, an annual runway show, to a certain extent, is counter to that whole principle. So, you know, it's much bigger than what the consumer going to a Walmart looking for that look that may have been on, you know, the Oscars, you know, two nights before is about. It really comes down to, you know, how the fashion industry conceives itself.
Well, so, but getting back to durability, appliances is a good example. I mean, on the one, the appliances themselves are getting so complicated with their sort of electronic brains here that it's getting hard to have the basic skills to repair them. That's an issue. We've done Right to Repair shows, by the way, which just really set the phones on fire too. But also, I mean, look, businesses are based on selling people stuff. I can't imagine that LG, just to pick on them for a second, like they don't necessarily want someone to have a washing machine that lasts them 30 years. They'd much prefer you buying a new washing machine every 5 years.
Right. Well, in the book, I have an example. It's a company called Alliance Laundry Systems, which is based in Ripon, Wisconsin. And they have they are the world's largest manufacturer of commercial laundry systems. So if you go to a laundromat anywhere in the world, you're likely going to see one of their laundry machines under what's called the Speed Queen brand. And if you make a washing machine for a laundromat, you're going to make a very durable machine, because the laundromat does not want to have that machine down for any period of time. They're losing money on it. So the way a business like a laundromat buys a washing machine is they aren't thinking about the first cost, meaning the price. They're thinking about the long-term cost of ownership. And what Alliance did, which is pretty interesting, is a few years back they said, you know, we want to re-enter the consumer washing machine market and compete with the Maytags and the Westinghouses. And what they did was they said, you know, we're going to take these machines we're making for coin-operated laundries and we're going to offer them to consumers, and they're going to be much more expensive. They average out about $300 more for a basic machine, but they are said to last. The company claims, you know, in all their literature, and they have big stickers on machines, they will last 25 years, which is pretty extraordinary, because if you buy other brands, you'll see maybe this part will last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But if you see a guarantee, you know, for 25 years, that's pretty extraordinary. And Speed Queen, too, it's, I think, their surprise. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but, you know, certainly to the industry surprises, had incredible success with this. And they found that you do have consumers who are willing to sort of think like businesses, and instead of making first cost their principle for buying something, they're thinking about the long-term cost of ownership. So instead of buying a new washing machine every 5 to 7 years, which is what you do with the more common consumer brands, maybe you can buy it every 25 years. And that makes economic sense, and it gets to, you know, what the benefits are for a consumer of durability, but it also helps out the manufacturers, because the manufacturers can charge more.
Well, let's go back to our phones really quickly. Eduardo is calling from Santa Monica, California. Eduardo, you're on the air.
Hi. So here's my dilemma. I live out on the West Coast, and so my parents were Generation Depression era generation, and they live in New England in a small town in Massachusetts. So they collected more than enough share of everything. There was never enough because they were poor and they never knew when their next meal was going to be. So it translates into material things. So now we're cleaning out my mother's house, the barn, the stable, blah, blah, blah. No one wants carnival glass set of dishes that my uncle got from Korea, or my grandmother's hand-carved wooden furniture, or the porcelain ice cream scoops. And so I'm trying to get you know, a newer generation involved in the value and the provenance of things, but they just want to really sit on the couch, order from Amazon, and have it delivered.
Oh.
So there's a whole generational divide that, you know, there's education, and I can't wait to read your book also.
Well, Eduardo, I'm going to take it back from you because we have a minute left to go before a break. I don't know about those porcelain ice cream scoops, but certainly there's got to be, I mean, Adam, there has to be a huge market for some hand-carved furniture.
No.
No?
I mean, there's not. And the price has crashed in recent years. And it's because the people who love that stuff, that Depression generation, you know, they're passing away. And so that stuff doesn't have value. But now you have a whole new generation of collectors who have the money. And Gen X is buying things like $2,000 Pyrex bowls and, you know, hundreds of dollars, you know, Star Wars figures worth hundreds of dollars. So the collectibles market is changing.
Oh, okay. I was thinking Gen X might get away with from the microscope of criticism about consumerism, but it touches us all. We're talking to Adam Minter this hour. His new book is Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Adam Minter. His new book is Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And Adam, wow, we have so many comments here. Kate Eade says, old saying in Vermont, use it up, wear it out, use it again, or do without. Lucky number 13 says, I'm a thrifter. I sell on eBay, Etsy, and Facebook. It breaks my heart to see how much perfectly good and new items get tossed. My home looks like a catalog, but it's all secondhand. And then someone calling themselves But I Digress says, as a new adult 20 years ago, I decided to buy as much as I could, excluding anything that would be gross, like underwear, secondhand. Good call there, but I digress. But I'm still able to meet all my family's needs this way, even as we've struggled financially. And then there's this one more comment here, Adam. Christina O'Neill says, some years ago, a dear colleague held a housewarming at a large dream home that she and her husband had worked for Lord knows how long. While at the event, she said to me in an aside, I feel sorry for the kids after we'll be gone. They'll be stuck with 11 rooms of furniture. Okay, so back to the phones here. Patrick is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hello, yes, thank you very much for allowing me on air, and I love the show, by the way. I think my point I would like to ask the your guest is the issue of dumping. I'm from Africa, and when mm-hmm. I was growing up, we used to, you know, take clothes to the tailor, somebody to tailor them up for you, and you make your own clothes pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, there's so much of these used stuff that comes in these countries, which have pretty much decimated some of the textile industries. As of recent, Rwanda and Kenya, I think, decided to put a ban on these products. And in Rwanda, when that happened, the big lobby companies that lobby the U.S. government here that deal in this stuff went ahead and they decided, the U.S. government decided to cancel Rwanda's duty-free importation of its products into the U.S. So these things are not really harmless. They affect people. A lot of people have lost jobs. On top of that, there's a lot of dumping, like especially computers and electronics, which are very, very toxic stuff that they send to Africa.
Patrick, so you've brought up two very important points that Adam does address directly in his book. So let's talk about them. Patrick, thank you so much for your call. So Adam, first of all, when Patrick talks about industries like tailors, he's from Uganda, who've gone out of business because of the flood of secondhand clothing, talk about that.
Sure. Well, I think it's less than clear that you can blame the crash in the African continent's textile and apparel industry solely on secondhand. At the time that Africa's textile and clothing industry started to decline, there were two things happening. One, you did see greater and greater exports from developed countries, Japan to Europe, including the United States, of secondhand clothes into Africa. But the other thing that happened is something that many Americans will also identify with, and that was trade liberalization and the large-scale export of low-cost new garments from Southeast Asia and China into Africa. And those were able to outcompete price-wise the new garments being manufactured within Africa. And so as much, if not more, in my opinion, and looking at the data of the decline of Africa's apparel and textile industry, you really have to point at the competition from new low-cost goods coming in from Asia. And that's something that Americans will find very familiar. And when that happened, you had secondhand available to sort of fill some of the gaps that were there, especially for folks who have the desire to own new or better durable goods.
Okay. Interesting. So what about electronics, though? Because as Patrick said, and I think he's reflecting what a lot of people sort of presume, that these are toxic materials. Where he used the word dumping, that we're dumping them on developing nations. But you have a slightly different take on that.
Right. Well, I'm not a fan of the term dumping because I think the term dumping kind of gives a misperception of what's actually going on here. The way global trade works, whether it's new goods or secondhand goods, is there needs to be somebody who buys it, literally, because shipping companies, the big shipping companies, whether, the Costcos and the Mariks who operate these giant shipping lines, they are not just going to accept a container in New York City and send it to Africa without somebody who's signing on to purchase it. It's very expensive, for example, just to send a container from Boston to Ghana. It runs around $5,000, I believe. So the question that I always find interesting is, who is buying this stuff and why are they doing it in Africa? And more often than not, the reason that these materials are being purchased by Africans and imported at very large costs is for the reuse market. And if you go to a place, I spent quite a bit of time in Accra, Ghana, most of the electronics you see being used in these towns are imported secondhand. In Ghana, mostly it's coming in from Europe, but there's still a significant amounts coming in from Africa. And these are devices, some of them which are coming in don't work at the time that they're imported, but they can be repaired. And you have marvelous, some of the best technicians in the world who are able to fix these devices that would get tossed into a dump or a certified recycling operation here in the United States. They are fixing them in Africa. More often than not, when you see pictures coming out of Africa of electronics being burnt or recycled in improper means, these are not materials that are coming freshly off the boat, just imported. It wouldn't make any economic sense. Your average television only has $2-3 worth of precious metals within it. And yet, if you look at the shipping manifests, people are paying far more than that for the television. So they, if it's being dumped there, somebody would be actually be paying to set it on fire, which doesn't make sense. But the stuff you are seeing being set on fire is the stuff that's been in these countries for 20, 30, 40 years and has been used and reused, and there is no good recycling operation after it's actually been used. And that's where the problems come in. And this is where things get very complicated, because you have to ask yourself then, if I have this phone, say, in New York City, and I'm only going to use it for 3 years, but if it's exported to Africa, it may get used, say, in Ghana for another 5 to 7 years, whereas in the United States, it may not, it may end up just getting trashed. What's better? What's the better option, even if at the end of its life, some of that phone may not be recycled properly in Africa? And there's no black and white here. It's all gray, or no black and green. It's a very, sort of morally complex set of questions.
Isn't the best option to use the phone in New York for an additional 5 to 7 to 10 years and also demand that Apple, Google, Samsung, they all don't make them obsolete. Isn't that
yes.
the best option?
That is the best option. And to add to that option, there should be, these large manufacturers of electronics should have to start taking some degree of responsibility for the disposal of those electronics in emerging markets, which simply don't have good recycling options yet.
Well, let's go back to the phone. Sebastian is calling from Montgomery, Vermont. Sebastian, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Great to talk to you. Great show, by the way. We listen every day, even in the deepest snow. But I'm calling because I actually have two online antique businesses. I had a store, but we ended up closing the store because what we found was that what we were selling was 5-to-1. Now, we started in our antique businesses because we lived in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and we had a huge recycling center. So people were dumping amazing, beautiful porcelain, silver, glass, even beautiful antique furniture. And we started doing it as a local charity organization fundraising thing, which has now turned into my own business. And we do it now in northern Vermont for two local organizations as well as for ourselves. And my partner and I are both retired, so it adds a nice boost to our income personally. Plus, we also raise a couple of $1,000 a year for the library and also for our local art center. And what I'm finding is that there's a whole other world of people buying antiques that wouldn't buy them in a store. And they're paying top dollar for them, too.
And how do they find you, Sebastian?
Etsy.com, Google search, and also through our website and our other things. So it's been this interesting sort of underlying thing of things that people thought couldn't be sold, or you'd have to sell just through a gallery or through an antique shop. But and our largest client base is between 20 and 35 and 40 years old. So we are definitely selling beautiful porcelain, beautiful silver. I even just put up a Ming coat the other day that I've had waiting for a while to go for sale from the 1950s. So it's this really, really interesting thing that's happened, and it's created a whole other business for me.
Wow. Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for your call, and I guess I'll have to I'll take back my thoughts on porcelain ice cream scoopers.
Right.
But Adam, it seems like Sebastian, they're saying that he is finding a market for this stuff.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be exceptions. And one of the great things about the internet is that, prior to the internet, you had an antique store. And if somebody walked in, if you had an antique ice cream scoop in there and nobody ever walked through your store, who wanted one, it would never sell, even though there may be one, a collector 500 miles away. And that's the beauty of the internet is that it is able to connect sellers and buyers and sellers in diverse locations and ensure that stuff gets sold. But by and large, the market for collectibles is not in a good place right now, especially the traditional collectibles. It's just the interest level is declining, and it's more the exception than it is the rule. And I think it's super cool, and I think it's great that Sebastian is having success in it. But if you go especially to the traditional antique stores and antique malls, they're really suffering. And even the folks selling on eBay will tell you that, a lot of them will tell you that the search is getting harder and the margins are getting tighter because there just aren't as many people as there used to be interested in these things.
Even though Sebastian's still enjoying that 5-to-1 margin, which I was pretty impressed by.
Yeah, but, no, it's fantastic.
But Adam, we have to talk for a moment about China, right? Because it is the place where so much of these low price point new goods are coming from. The nation itself, still relatively, and I put the unquote, relatively new to sort of superpowered consumerism within China. Are we seeing attitudes around secondhand goods changing there?
Yes, you are, partly out of just flat necessity. I lived in Shanghai for 12 years, and there were two phenomena that I really noticed related to affluence there. Number one, the children got taller in my 12 years in China. Nutrition got better. And two, the hallway of my apartment building started overflowing with stuff from people's apartments. They were acquiring too, but they didn't have garages to put the stuff, so they just put it in the hallway. And that's a pretty common thing. thing you'll find in Chinese apartments. And as homes in China overflow with all this stuff that they've been buying, you are seeing the emergence of secondhand businesses there. The kind of businesses you see here, they have their own versions of eBays and Poshmarks and some of these new fashion platforms that allow people to buy and sell each other's clothes. But increasingly, you know, that stuff's only at the top end. And so sort of the middle and lower middle class clothing, sort of the Targets and the Walmarts and the clothing that's accessible to most people, you know, it doesn't make sense really to be selling that stuff online. And so it's what's happening there is sort of what's happened in developed countries. It's flowing to big wholesalers, and those wholesalers are starting to look abroad to sell that stuff. And in the last few years, the world's largest the world's fastest growing source of used clothing, including into Africa, has been from China. And that's an interesting phenomenon and not necessarily a good one for the used clothing trade globally, because it means that you have this flood of supply and it's driving down the price and making new goods look more attractive.
Well, let's take one more call. Liz is calling from Vermont. Liz, did I say that right?
You sure did. Congratulations. How many people do say it right? Good morning.
Every once in a while, I get lucky. I get lucky every once in a while. But go ahead, Liz.
Okay, so a group of 11 women 10 years ago, we put together a resale shop for women, children, and families in need and hospice. And the way we did it, we got all these things that would normally go into the landfill, couches, tables, chairs, and china, and kitchenware. And we've now, over these 11 years, we've been able to give over $400,000 back into the community, just reselling what people don't want. And it's just been a phenomenon here. And I would tell you one sad thing is I'm one of the people that cleans, opens up the boxes when they come in. And I opened the most gorgeous set of china, and it was wrapped in newspaper from 1969.
Wow.
So it hadn't seen the light of day since 1969. And I just, it makes me use my china. I tell my grandchildren, you set the table. You choose what you want to put on. I don't care if it gets chipped. I don't want it wrapped up and put in the attic. So it's been a very good run for us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, Liz. Adam, we've just got 2 minutes left here, and Liz's call makes me think, you know, around the periphery of this conversation has been just the overabundance of stuff, and that in and of itself being a problem, and perhaps for those of us who are able to, we should just reduce our consumption. But Liz also got me back to thinking about, like, it's part of the problem that we just continue to put value in things, whereas Liz is talking about now she's shifting value to experience. Like, the experience, it's not the china that matters. It's getting her grandkids to set the table so that they can all eat together. I mean, isn't that something that we ought to be thinking more of? Is like, why do we think things are so meaningful rather than experiences around them?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things I found interesting in reporting this book is I spent, you know, a lot of time with the people who clean out other people's stuff, both in the United States and in Japan. And along the way, almost all of them said the same thing, is that having seen all of this stuff piling up in people's homes and seeing sort of the emotional effect it has on them and their children and other relatives and friends, they've stopped buying as much. They've stopped consuming as much because they see the negative effects of it mentally, socially, even spiritually. And they have transitioned to buying better stuff, buying less stuff, buying in terms of experiences. One cleanup professional in Minneapolis told me, you know, our wedding gifts now are not, you know, the china. We are buying gift certificates, you know, for restaurants or holidays somewhere. You know, again, it's moving to those things that bring us together as people and away from stuff which oftentimes separate us.
Well, Adam Minter's new book is Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. He's also author previously of Junkyard Planet. Adam, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.